More than a decade has passed since the Arab Spring began, but I bet you can still tell how you felt about it, can't you? Personally, I felt like this would be a very good thing. Sounds naive in hindsight, but I'm sure I wasn't the only one. Why else would they have used the word spring, right? That clearly signals the expectation that better times lay ahead. And the protesters sure looked like they would be on the right side of history. When the movement just got off the ground, there was little doubt that it was driven by the justified anger of the poor masses, who were fed up with their longtime oppressors. They'd had it with their incompetence, their cruelty, and most of all, their corruption. It all started in Tunisia, where a poor fruit salesman set himself on fire in protest against his mistreatment by the authorities. Apparently, the indignation had built up to such levels over the years that people were now willing to take to the streets regardless of the consequences. It was hard not to feel sympathy and admiration for that. Western governments seemed sympathetic too at the time. In general, they cautiously applauded the rebels or encouraged dictators to listen to their people. The hope was that this would lead to the adoption of Western values. But understandably, Americans and Europeans were reluctant to lend a helping hand, not knowing how things would turn out. And polite encouragement did seem to suffice at first. Hopes were raised by the events in Tunisia. Merely a few weeks after Mohamed Bouazizi set himself alight, President Ben Ali had already fled his country. The Western world seemed mostly cheerful about that, but also a little nervous. Because after all, they didn't know what was going to replace these dictators, some of whom had not been unwilling to work with the West. Case in point, President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. He didn't go down as quietly as Ben Ali, and when he did, it was the Muslim Brotherhood that took over. This made many onlookers very uncomfortable. The brothers were Islamists and not exactly pro-Western, but at least they seemed willing to give democracy a try. Well, sort of. That in itself made others anxious. Autocracies, namely, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. If other Arab countries could get rid of their rulers, that might give their own subjects bad ideas. They couldn't fail to notice that the Arab Spring proved extremely contagious, as revolutions usually are, especially if its basic causes are present elsewhere, too. As it happened, a place like Saudi Arabia is not exactly known for its transparency or human rights either, so it's easy to see why such countries wanted these movements to fail, especially if the powers that now stepped into the forefront were no friends of theirs, like the Muslim Brotherhood. Meanwhile, Qatar did its best to help spread the enthusiasm, or the contagion if you will, through its Al Jazeera media network. The Saudis reacted by coming to the aid of friendly autocrats, like in Bahrain, or when the dictator in question was their enemy, by bankrolling their own preferred type of rebel. That was not a secular or democratic-minded sort, usually. Iran tried to influence the outcome in the opposite direction by sponsoring pro-Shiite parties. Partly because of these conflicting outside influences, the countries affected by the Arab Spring would become arenas of proxy wars, and at the end of it all, few of them, if any, are any better off than before. Spring turned to winter. This may be the worst disappointment concerning international politics I've lived through, the biggest lost opportunity. No one has done more to bring it about than the Assad regime of Syria. The Arab Spring had a unique dynamic in every country that it affected. As we saw in the first series, in Yemen, for example, it was merely a new phase in an already ongoing conflict. In Tunisia, the spark was provided by a desperate action of a salesman. And in Syria, it was graffiti. After the first dictators had been toppled, schoolchildren in Deraa had scrambled, "You're next, doctor," on a wall, clearly referring to the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, who had been trained as an eye specialist. Apparently, the security services thought that the proper reaction to this would be to track down the kids, lock them up, and torture them. When the fathers came pleading for their return, the answer was that they should first send over their wives. This is so gruesome and disproportionate that you'd have to be made of stone not to get enraged by it, I think. My own stomach still turns when rereading about this years later. How do you think you would react if this was your child? It's no wonder that family and friends exploded with anger. What is more striking is that these demonstrations then engulfed large parts of the city. There had been other displays of regime cruelty in the past, sadly enough, but people were too terrified to come onto the streets for fear that the police would then come after their own beloved ones, and they didn't have much hope that the regime could be brought down. It had been in power for as long as most Syrians could remember. This time was different, however. This time, their anger proved stronger than their fear, and the most logical reason for that is that at that point, with the Arab Spring in full swing, no one doubted anymore whether dictators could be toppled. The proof was all over the news. At first, Assad still half-heartedly came up with a few small concessions to calm and divide the protesters, but he quickly resorted to the iron-fisted approach that had been customary in Syria. Peaceful protesters were confronted by sniper fire and other violence, but this only made matters worse, and soon enough the regime lost control of the streets in many districts. Worse for Assad, plenty of soldiers refused to fight their own countrymen. That is pretty brave given the possible ramifications for themselves and their families. But on the other hand, imagine having to fight for a regime that tortures children against your own people merely because they complain about that. Most of us can't even imagine being in a situation like that. Of course, once they had refused to fight, they couldn't just return home. Many, if not most, defected to the rebels, along with their weapons. And that would mean that the protest would quickly evolve into a civil war. The regime realized it could not hope to keep control over the entire rebel territory, so it withdrew from such areas, only to smoke them out mercilessly. To stay behind in these places, in the eyes of the regime, amounted to high treason. Of course, not everyone there was an active rebel. Many just wouldn't or couldn't leave their homes and friends behind, and becoming a refugee is not exactly an easy step anyway. But the regime didn't see that as an excuse. It resorted to collective punishment in the most brutal ways imaginable. One of the very worst tactics, if you can even call it that, was bombing hospitals. When medics, rescue workers, and firefighters showed up to help, the warplanes would return to bomb them too. And they even went after the ambulances that managed to pick up the wounded. In no time, rebel-held regions had almost no more doctors or medical facilities, which would be horrible in any situation, let alone in an atrocious war. This is all the more stunning because Bashar al-Assad was himself trained as an eye surgeon, according to The Economist, because he couldn't stand the sight of blood. I still find it unbelievable that someone who studied so hard to learn about curing people, who worked in a hospital himself, would then go ahead and mass murder other doctors. But then, as a writer in The Guardian once proposed, perhaps it takes a doctor to understand how effective, in air quotes, this would be, if the effect you're going for is to make people surrender in despair. Another just as devious tactic that the regime used was to turn the war into a struggle between sects and religions. In the earliest phases of the protests, Assad already started calling demonstrators germs, unmistakably the sort of hate speech that often announces genocide. Spreading fear about the other groups proved sadly effective. Sunnis are a majority in Syria, and they have been repressed there for decades. Minorities dreaded what they might do if they somehow got the upper hand, and Assad played on these fears. Alawites, the sect to which the ruler himself belongs, formed the most staunchly loyalist militias. But many Christians and Shiites were also convinced to fight for the regime. Meanwhile, most of the army men that deserted were Sunni. And the Kurds, for their part, couldn't resist the temptation to consolidate their own enclaves in the north. So the opposition was divided from the start, and this would gradually worsen because of the divide and rule tactics of the regime and the involvement of outside powers with opposing interests. To properly understand this, we first need to take a look at what was happening across the border in Iraq. There, sectarian violence had started even earlier. Iraq was in majority Shiite, but it had been ruled by Sunni strongmen until the Americans toppled Saddam Hussein and imposed a democracy. This had already led to sectarian conflicts early on, but over time, things had calmed down a little bit. That period of relative quiet came to an end, however, when the Americans announced their plans to withdraw. Politicians anticipated that this would create a power vacuum that would surely be filled by Iran, and so they tried to gain Tehran's favor straight away. Sunni representation in key institutions was subsequently hollowed out. Sunnis increasingly felt that they were becoming second-class citizens in Iraq. A reaction would come in the form of the terror group called ISIL. It had started as an Al-Qaeda offshoot, which was trying to take advantage of the chaos in the early years of the American occupation. But by the time that the Americans started preparing their departure, they had gravely been battered, mostly because even most Sunnis, which was their target audience, were put off by their radicalism. But then, as I just explained, the government became much more anti-Sunni, and this threw them a lifeline, the terrorists I mean. They profited even more from the chaos in neighboring Syria, which gave them a place to regroup, train, and collect resources. Failed states are often breeding grounds for terrorists. The war against Assad attracted foreign combatants, some of whom could be persuaded to join the jihadis. For the outside world, it was hard to keep track of what was happening in Syria. It was too dangerous for observers to work there, and all parties were spreading disinformation. ISIL also took full advantage of the fact that the armies involved were not eager to cross borders, because of the political risks involved. ISIL, for its part, simply dismissed these borders as colonial artifacts. They declared that their future state would span the entire region, and so they had no qualms, of course, about crossing state borders. Like cowboy bandits that could feel safe once they were in Mexico. All of a sudden, ISIL started expanding at a frightening pace. Few had seen that coming. Terror groups don't usually grab so much territory. And through slick propaganda, they made it look as if they were even stronger than they actually were. They were very good at making it seem as if the day of final judgment was nearing. According to a poll by the Pew Research Center, in 2012, more than 70% of Iraqis would believe that they would witness the coming of the Mahdi in their own lifespan. I must admit I had to reread that multiple times because I was convinced my eyes were fooling me. Now, you didn't have to believe that the end of times was at hand to panic under these conditions. I suppose this explains why Mosul, Iraq's third largest city, fell almost overnight. Reportedly, many of the defending soldiers, who far outnumbered the attackers, ran for their lives. ISIL's success had become self-reinforcing. They then declared that their spectacular success was proof that Allah smiled upon their works, and they urged all the true believers worldwide to come defend the new caliphate, as they called it. Apparently, this touched a nerve with countless youngsters on the dole. Many of ISIL's fresh recruits were petty criminals who probably reckoned that, by fighting for the self-declared caliph, they might regain a sense of purpose and self-respect. Of course, there were also plenty of sociopaths looking forward to indulge in their most base instincts. For such creatures, ISIL offered many perks that no one else would, such as the right to keep Yazidi women as sex slaves or torturing civilians in the most sickening ways with impunity. Again, like with the horrors of the Assad regime, I find it impossible to talk about this in an unbiased manner. The images are still too fresh in my memory bank, and I was personally untouched by all this. It happened thousands of miles away, so I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like for those who actually had to live through this. Many of these victims, by the way, still live among the people who did this to them. Some have been rounded up in camps where ISIL veterans run the show in practice. Just quickly, if I may, there is no way around the fact that the recent history of these countries is a sad and bloody one, and it is therefore tempting for me to turn this whole series into one long lament. But who would want to listen to that, truly? And does anyone really need a reminder of the evil stuff that happened there recently? I would much prefer to focus on explanations, as usual, It's just that you can never begin to understand what happened and why without taking into account the emotions that were involved: fear, indignation, grief. So I think it would be a mistake to ignore them or even try to keep an emotional distance all the time. Now, the acts of ISIL and the Assad regime seem uniquely horrific to us, but that is because it is so close to our beds. We are quicker to take an objective look, in air quotes, when we are talking about, say, the reign of the ancient Assyrians. Only, as we'll yet see, these were just as vicious as ISIL, if not more so. And back in their day, emotions were, of course, just as crucial as they are now. We just don't feel that same connection anymore due to the distance in time and culture. Perhaps the emotional ties that we feel with victims today can help us realize, at least a little better, what was playing out 4,000 years ago. I can already say that when we will eventually get to that, I'll compare the Assyrian methods of ruling with those of ISIL and the region's long-ruling dictators, and I think you'll be surprised how little has changed over the millennia. But for now, the point that I'm trying to make is that talking about this is not gratuitous. In my view, it's necessary. I don't want to turn misery into entertainment, far from it, and I certainly mean no disrespect to any of the victims. I just hope you'll understand that this is like walking a tightrope, so please cut me some slack on this. Emotions, I think, go a long way explaining how the fight against ISIL went. The terrorists used open cruelty to intimidate their foes, just like Assad, by the way. They made videos of the beheading or burning of captives. This sends a clear message. You really want to fight us? See what that we'll do to you. But as it turned out, many nations indeed came to fight them, partly out of sheer indignation. And I must admit, at the time, I felt like this was a bad idea. As a rule, terrorists don't mean to destroy their targets directly, after all. Instead, they want them to lash out, to overreach, so that the victims of the retaliation would be radicalized and driven into the terrorists' arms. That was what Al-Qaeda had successfully done by attacking the Twin Towers. And there was clearly a risk that history would repeat itself in this case. I still think that was ISIL's intention. How else to explain that they challenged practically the whole world to come fight them? When America and others obliged, I felt like they were walking into the same trap all over again. Now, I still think this was a gamble, and it's still early days to say whether it was a good one, but for now, I think the events seem to have proven me wrong. And that is, I think, because the terrorists miscalculated. If they wanted to pose as the champions of local Sunnis, then they should at least have been friendly to them. Instead, they treated them with brutality, too. Most were aghast about the sheer inhumanity of their actions, anyway, and little wonder. For would you support someone who burns people alive simply because they say they do it for your sake? It's not hard to see how this would invite revenge, what was probably what they were going for all along. Even other jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda balked at ISIL's indiscriminate cruelty, which is saying something, I think. Then again, as we'll yet see, ISIL was a totally different type of creature from Al-Qaeda. They weren't satisfied with being activists or martyrs. They wanted to be rulers. And at some point, ISIL did control about half of Syria and a third of Iraq. You can make a ton of money that way, and so they did. By robbing, extorting, and taxing civilians, by plundering banks and museums, by selling oil. But all that meant inflicting a heavy toll on the inhabitants of their so-called state, and it also meant that the world couldn't just wait for all those billions to be spent on terror attacks. With Syria in chaos and the borders looking like Swiss cheese, new recruits easily kept coming in. And once ISIL controlled a considerable amount of territory, it could make a totally new sort of propaganda film, in which they could show off how good life in their state supposedly was. This contrasted sharply with the old-fashioned sales talk of Al-Qaeda, which was basically, blow yourself up, it's for a good cause, and that will be that then. A bit fatalistic if you think about it. Not so surprising that it had limited appeal. ISIL, on the other hand, were saying, we are winning right now. Come join us, there's a good life for you here. You know where to find us. That proved much more effective as a recruiting strategy. Newcomers were indoctrinated on the spot and robbed of all their empathy by having to witness harrowing cruelty day in, day out, trained to kill without mercy. And then some were sent back to wreak havoc in their country of origin. Others, though, had escaped after they got a taste of what ISIL's utopia would be like in real life. It was impossible to tell one from the other. So what did you have to do with these returnees? If you locked them up, together with other criminals, they were likely to spread their creed further. Even ISIL's senior leaders had often been radicalized inside prison camps. So you wouldn't want to repeat that mistake. But if you locked them in solitary confinement for ages, even if that were possible, that would discourage defections. Besides, how could you tell terrorists from genuine refugees anyway, who had done nothing wrong? Indeed, what about the locals, most of whom were just trapped and didn't want anything to do with terrorism? Non-Sunnis were at the risk of being slaughtered, raped, enslaved. What was done to the Yazidis practically amounted to genocide, and that was perhaps but a foretaste of what was in store for non-Sunnis in ISIL's territory. Finally, what about the children? Their so-called education was pure child abuse. ISIL was training a whole generation to become traumatized mass murderers without any sense of empathy. A social engineering program that was worse than what the Nazis had in mind. Surely the world couldn't just let that happen. So a very broad coalition of Sunni, Shiite, and non-Muslim countries attacked the so-called caliphate. Perhaps they had been a bit too optimistic by challenging the entire world. By 2017, ISIL had lost all territory in Iraq, and 2 years later, the self-declared caliph had blown himself up in Syria. By that point, however, the uneasy coalition against his organization was practically dead already. ISIL's enemies, both local and foreign, were more interested in fighting each other. Indeed, it was the antagonism between them that mostly explains why ISIL had proved relatively hard to eliminate. Take the Iraqi army for starters. In practice, this was more like a collection of feuding sectarian militias. And that saddled the Iraqi government with a tricky dilemma. Who best to send to fight a group that presents itself as the champion of Sunnis? If you send Shiite militias, that was likely to prove ISIL's point, because some of these militias would certainly commit cruelties against the local population, as happens in almost any conflict. If these are by definition then acts by Shiites against Sunnis, that pours gasoline on the sectarian hatred. It would further fuel Sunni anger against the government and fear against Shiites in general. It would drive the locals into ISIL's arms. On the other hand, if you send in Sunni militias, some might feel more connected to their co-religionists than to the government. You then run the risk that some will defect, pass on important intel, or resort to sabotage even. So that might backfire too. There was a third option, and that was seen as the least bad of the lot, the Kurdish Peshmerga. These were Sunnis too, but known for their religious tolerance, or indifference perhaps. So they were unlikely to sympathize with a group like ISIL, or to inflict cruelties out of sectarian hatred. So at first sight, they looked like they were ideally placed to fight in the Sunni heartland. Except that this risked furthering the separatist goals of their leaders. For instance, the Kurds took over the region around Kirkuk to shield it from the jihadi advance. But it was not a secret that the Kurds had their eyes set on Kirkuk's oil fields for a long time. It would help their autonomous region become much more economically viable. And not long after, the Iraqi Kurds will hold a referendum on independence. In the eyes of their Arab compatriots, that was a knife in the back. The Kurds were now seen to be taking advantage of the instability of Iraq to advance their own separatist goals. More chaos in Iraq might be better for Kurdistan, they would argue. From that perspective, the Kurds might not be the ideal group to depend upon after all. There was also a precarious position of the Arabs in Kirkuk. Many of these families had been brought there by previous dictators to consolidate the grasp of the central government. Some feared that the Kurds might now try to revert this process, and this further fueled the ethnic tensions, of course. The same can be said about Syria, While in most of that country, Syrians looked after their own co-religionists, in the north, the Kurds would look after their own ethnicity. They stopped using the Arabic language or Syrian money, speaking Kurdish and trading in dollars instead. Thanks to their oil, they were mostly sold, over the Iraqi border now, the Syrian Kurds were financially in a better shape than the Arab parts of the country, as were their counterparts in Iraq, by the way. Young people signed up for the Kurdish forces en masse, often forcibly so. This also made them a force to be reckoned with, and that Assad preferred not to focus on at first. It looked as if the Kurdish region would be able to survive on its own. They even experimented with new forms of bottom-up government, partly inspired by the ideas of the incarcerated PKK leader Öcalan. This would of course unnerve Ankara. As far as the Turks were concerned, there was no difference between ISIL and the Syrian Kurdish YPG. They considered them both terrorist organizations. And at home, the Turkish government sometimes seemed to see Kurdish nationalism as a bigger threat than Islamic radicalism. On the other hand, Erdogan also took military action against ISIL, while at the same time, he was among the most fervent opponents of the Assad regime too, long before the Arab Spring started even. So he was against almost every major player in the Syrian conflict. Hard to tell what his ideal scenario might look like. What is clear, however, is that he wouldn't allow the border to act as a conduit for Kurdish separatists, the way that the Iraqi-Syrian border had been for ISIL. The PKK had already found shelter in Syria under Bashar Assad's father until the 90s, and later in Iraqi Kurdistan too. Erdogan wanted to make it very clear that the border would offer them no protection this time. His troops crossed the Syrian border, occupying territory that had been controlled by ISIL and by the Syrian Kurds. This provided a safe haven for rebels that Turkey liked, while allowing it to better control who gets in and out of Turkey. That applied to separatists or terrorist agitators, but also to refugees. There were millions of them in Turkey by that point, and though they were cared for rather well when compared to other places, their welcome was wearing out. Politically, that was not illogical, but it raised tensions with their NATO partner, the USA. For the US had used both the Syrian and Iraqi Kurds as their proxies to combat ISIL. Perhaps that was the main point of the invasion, signaling to the US that Turkey wouldn't keep accepting America's protection of the Syrian Kurds. And indeed, Donald Trump would announce that he would withdraw the few thousand American troops that were there, mostly in the Kurdish area of Syria, leaving his former allies totally exposed to Turkey, but most of all perhaps to Assad. It's a bit ironic then that Turkey had long accused the USA of apathy when it came to Syria, more precisely for having done next to nothing to stop Bashar al-Assad from killing his own people. It has a point. The Assad regime had much more firepower, of course, and if it was willing to use airplanes and tanks against its own civilians, how could the latter ever hope to rein him in without outside help? Indeed, America was shamed almost as much for failing to intervene in Syria as it had been for having intervened in Iraq. Yet these two are interrelated. It's no coincidence that the unofficial doctrine of the successor of George W. Bush Jr. would be, "Don't do stupid shit." The invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan is not exactly considered a great move nowadays, and if anyone needed a reminder of what might go wrong if Assad should fall, then they got one when Libya descended into chaos after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi. This even has spillover effects in the wider region that lasts to this day. And yet, Barack Obama could hardly be seen as standing idly by as citizens were slaughtered. In 2012, he announced that the use of chemical weapons would be a red line for his administration. This was no doubt well-intentioned. The last thing that the Assad regime would want was for the USA to come to the aid of his enemies. They had seen what had happened to Saddam Hussein, after all. The problem was that for the rebels, this would be the best thing that could happen. Who then had the objective interest in provoking this, or making it appear as if something like that had occurred? It was their best chance, perhaps their only chance, of defeating the regime. And lo and behold, shortly after, poison gas was used in Syria. The question was, by whom? It was certain that Assad had poison gas and lots of it. But what did he have to gain by using it? He had the military advantage already. This wouldn't change the course of the war. The regime itself pointed to the rebels, of course, who controlled much of the country's territory anyway by that point, and so who maybe had captured some sarin gas too. Hard to tell at that time. What made this extra tricky was that, of course, it reminded everyone of the reason for the invasion of Iraq, the faulty intel that Saddam had a nuclear weapon. What if this happened again? What if the rebels had done this themselves to lure America into the war? No doubt the American president already regretted talking about a red line by this point, yet no intention of plunging into yet another open-ended conflict anyway, even as it became more and more likely that it was indeed the regime itself that had fired sarin gas on the Damascus suburb. And so he did something that American presidents hadn't usually bothered with since the 50s. He asked Congress for approval, but mostly to use it as a reason to backtrack on his promise, or to share the responsibility or the blame if the majority would vote for military action. It was very likely at the time that it would not pass the House, as polls showed that military action in Syria was very unpopular among voters. In the end, it never even came to a vote in the House. Russia drew a lifeline that Obama gratefully accepted. Moscow had come up with a plan for the dismantling of Syria's chemical weapons. Thousands of tons of nerve agent were effectively destroyed in the process, though chlorine would still be used in 2018, then prompting President Trump to respond immediately by ordering missile strikes. But I suspect only to invite people to contrast this resolve with his predecessor's inaction, because it accomplished next to nothing. All in all, the involvement of the US and its Western coalition in Syria has been modest. It waged some attacks against ISIL, but put only a few thousand boots on the ground, and mostly in Kurdish regions at that. Their most important contribution may have been that their presence there stopped the Kurds' many enemies from attacking them, for fear of hitting Americans by accident. And that was a risk for America too. For what if its troops accidentally found themselves exchanging bullets with Turkish, Iranian, or God forbid, Russian troops? Russia had been the most powerful player in the Syrian theater, at least since it became responsible for getting rid of Syria's chemical weapons. But the Assads had been Russian clients for a long time. The Russian fleet was stationed in Tartus Harbor, after all. An additional reason why America was weary of getting closely involved. In 2015, the Russians openly entered the war to come to the aid of Assad when he was about to be defeated by the rebels. This made them a big player again in the Middle East, for the first time since the fall of the Soviet Union. And that didn't go unnoticed by other despots who were on bad terms with America. These now understood that good relations with Russia might act as a lifeline. The echoes of this can still be heard in West Africa today, by example. This gave Putin many more bargaining chips to use against the West, which was trying to isolate him because of his invasion of Crimea. Maybe the Russian actions in Syria were most of all meant for showboating before the home public. And that worked, it seems. It did make many Russians proud. But there was always a risk that this would change once body bags started coming home in large numbers. The answer to that was to use the so-called Wagner Group, a mercenary company loosely linked to the Russian government. If Wagner men were killed, that didn't count as a Russian casualty. It's like a cheap accounting trick, and it could also provide some deniability if needed. The flip side to that coin was less accountability too, and so less restraint. This was just one of the many valuable lessons that the Russian military learned and tested through their involvement in Syria. Now, as far as the trick with the mercenaries is concerned, the Russians could also have learned this from America, which had deployed groups like Blackwater in Iraq for similar reasons and with similar results. Blackwater fell out of favor because some of its employees had misbehaved so badly. But Mr. Putin is not so easily impressed by the objections of human rights advocates. Perhaps the most problematic of all the foreign meddlers were the Saudis and the Iranians. As we've seen in the previous two series, since 1979, these two have divided much of the Arab world into warring blocs. And they've done more than a little to make the Arab Spring descend into a mishmash of sectarian civil conflicts. The rise of the fervently anti-Shiite ISIL would be a menace for Iran too, and so it held its nose and coordinated attacks with America. And also to avoid an accidental collision, no doubt. But as soon as this common enemy looked defeated, its enemies quickly turned on each other once again, especially after Donald Trump stepped out of the nuclear deal and imposed punishing sanctions on Iran. Trump made no secret of it that he didn't think America had any interests in Syria, apart from beating the terrorists. Iran could do all it wanted there for all he cared. When looked at the Arab Spring as a whole, Iran is often considered the biggest winner. There has even been talk of a Shiite crescent emerging. And in Iraq too, pro-Iranian militias and politicians did become dominant. This success might yet prove elusive, however, precisely because Iran is now so clearly able to enforce its will, many Iraqis have come to hold it responsible for the rampant corruption and for the fact that little of the oil wealth trickles down. Even Iran's longtime ally Muqtada al-Sadr has openly turned against it. Meanwhile, a victorious President Assad is slowly being readmitted into the international community. He's joined the Arab League again, and even his arch-nemesis Erdogan seems willing to bury the hatchet. At first sight, this attests to the Iranian victory. Assad was their ally. But the fact that he becomes less isolated means that inevitably his dependence on his protectors will lessen. Theirs was an alliance of convenience anyway. And finally, the public in Iran itself is more than fed up with Tehran's adventurism by this point. During the recent demonstrations, a popular slogan ran, "Forget Syria, remember us." In a way, it beggars belief that Assad, after all the horrors that he inflicted upon his own people, now seems to be accepted by countries who wanted him gone before. There are multiple reasons for that, but one of them, I'm sure, is an old autocrat's trick that he applied over the previous decade. He made it clear that his downfall would bring someone to power who is even worse and less predictable. He insisted from the start that his opponents were all radicals, and though this was clearly untrue at the time, he did all he could to make it a reality. He made sure to focus the attacks on the moderate, democratic-minded opposition. In other words, on those people that the West would consider acceptable alternatives. Meanwhile, violent extremists were even let out of prison. ISIL returned the favor. They also focused their attacks on moderate groups. As the latter inevitably lost control or were forced to close alliances with radical groups, it became ever more risky for Western governments to provide them with arms. What if these ended up in the hands of terrorists? As all hope faded that a moderate group might come out on top, what could America and France still hope to achieve by getting involved? Once Assad was reassured that decisive humanitarian interventions were no longer on the cards, he took his state terrorism tactics to the extreme. The war had started with anti-regime graffiti, as you'll remember. Now, the battered walls all over the country were filled with messages like "Kneel or starve," or "Assad, we burn the country." In practice, most Syrians didn't even get to choose one or the other. They got both. Assad reoccupied almost all of Syria, but it was in tatters. In the aftermath, he reorganized what was left of his country in ways that remind one of the West Bank. Ironically, since the Assad regime has always tried to present itself as a champion of the Palestinian cause, nowadays, many Syrian Sunnis compare their own fate to that of the Palestinians. Driven from their homes, prohibited from returning, then seeing their land confiscated and doled out to loyalists, and checkpoints everywhere to keep them in place, all in the name of security. And much like in Palestine, this is only likely to cause more frustration and hence violent resistance, I think. Many among the minorities, however, seem to have accepted the lesson that Assad wanted to teach them, that they can only keep their position and safety through repression. That's almost the same lesson that ISIL tried to teach Iraq Sunnis, that democracy is bad for them since they are the minority. Only repressing the majority can protect them. Much depends on the efforts of Iraq's elected politicians to convince them of the contrary. That is not impossible. The fight against ISIL partly became a success because America and others pressured the divisive al-Maliki to resign in favor of another prime minister who gave the Sunnis more say in the affairs of state. That was necessary to counter ISIL's narrative. The new government showed minorities that there was a place for them at the table, that they could make their voices heard within the democratic framework. Likewise, tensions with the Kurds softened after a deal about dividing oil profits was struck. So at first sight, compromise seemed to be the key to salvation. In practice, alas, this often entailed satisfying elites, not common people. On August 10th of this year, The Economist didn't mince words, stating that politicians of all ethnic and sectarian stripes have stashed away oil and tax money to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. As such corruption and wastefulness now comes to light, ordinary people, of course, get angry. They reckon that all this money could be better used to do something about the widespread poverty and unemployment, or to fix the country's abysmal infrastructure. Public annoyance about all this led to widespread civil disobedience campaigns that lasted for years. The demonstrators, however, can't agree on who is responsible for this mess. Some blame Iran, others the US, and not surprisingly, there is a growing group that accuses both. Muqtada al-Sadr, once a friend of Iran, is now pursuing a nationalist cause, for instance. All these groups, as well as the foreign governments backing them, try to discredit their rivals. Otherwise, peaceful demonstrations have repeatedly been marred by violent incidents. That may be due to the fact that organizers don't have tight control over their people, or, as they claim, these actions may be set up by their rivals to discredit them. Perpetrators of killings, abductions, and other intimidations are seldom caught, which keeps everybody guessing about their goals. And this also makes some point the finger at the government, which hasn't shown much restraint anyway. But most point to the different militias, who all profit from the dysfunctional system. Corruption probes are invariably declared politically motivated, which may well be true often enough, but that doesn't mean that the corruption isn't real. Meanwhile, the USA and Iran are flexing their muscles ever more openly, leaving Baghdad with few good options. It was forced to comply with economic sanctions against Iran, for example, but thereby it hurts itself, for it is very dependent on its neighbor for such basic things as food and electricity. In 2018, Iran temporarily blocked the export of such essentials in the midst of a heat wave. The resulting misery led to the fall of the Iraqi government. The US couldn't do much about this, even if it cared to. America and Iran are also not ashamed to kill each other's helpers on Iraqi soil. Just think of the elimination of Qasem Soleimani, the man in charge of Iran's foreign operations, or of the recurring attacks on embassies. This makes a mockery of Iraqi sovereignty, so no wonder that more and more Iraqis want them all out of their country. To suit the protesters, the government has proposed a more direct system of representation, but that implied diminishing the guaranteed representation of minorities. It sometimes seems as if you can't do anything about the entrenched elites without disturbing the delicate balance between groups. Iraq has yet to find an answer to this. This is unlikely, I think, as long as foreign meddlers don't show some restraint. Iraqis can see this all too clearly. Amid all the gloom, there is some hope that the sectarianism may diminish in the years to come. Iran and Saudi Arabia have taken steps towards reconciliation. For reasons that we've already touched upon, they seem to be losing their appetite for stoking sectarian strife. That would make the presence of America less necessary, or less explosive. The US itself wouldn't mind being less engaged in the region. It's pivoting towards East Asia anyway. And finally, as Assad seeks full recognition by Sunni states, He might just feel forced to tone down the suppression of his Sunni majority a little bit, although that seems unlikely for the moment. Needless to say, there is a lot that can go wrong. Fingers crossed. If you like the episode, or the show in general, feel free to give us a thumbs up by giving a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Talk to you soon. Bye.